I scandalized my brother while admitting he sang some pretty songs. It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing. I'm your host, Scott C. Welcome to the program, episode 48. Lots going on today, so let me just dive right in with some news from the Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications. The SAFTA Reading Series, the award-winning SAFTA Reading Series, returns to Knoxville when? Tomorrow, March 6th at 3 p.m. at the Lawson McGee Library, 500 West Church Avenue in Knoxville, Tennessee. This month out, the featured poets and writers are Rebecca Morgan Frank, TJ Jarrett, and Jordan Zandi, gonna put on a wonderful reading for you tomorrow afternoon, as I said, at the Lawson McGee Library on West Church Ave. If you've never been to the SAFTA Reading Series, then maybe you should consider going to it. And maybe you can't make it tomorrow, but that's okay. There's always going to be ones coming up in the future. And to get a handle on who's going to be coming into town, who's going to be reading, and what's going down, you can always find out all that information and more by visiting Facebook and searching for SAFTA Reading Series. There you'll find the SAFTA Facebook page for all of the reading informations as they come up, and you'll hear about them there first. Speaking of Facebook, Facebook is one of a number of social media networks now, and social media has been a boon for writers in that it allows writers of all different types and walks of life to talk to each other, communicate, network, etc., share work, collaborate, you know what I mean. But there is another mode, and it's a little more traditional, and that is the annual AWP convention. This year it is coming to Los Angeles, California, March 30th through April 2nd. Now it is that time of the season. Last year we had a lot of information for you, and this year is no different. Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts will be in attendance in Los Angeles at the end of the month, and they have a massive program of slate of information of stuff for you. That made very little sense, but I'm gonna go with it and press on. Not only will Sundress be having a massive off-site reading during that period, but they'll be having author signings at their table on the convention floor, celebrating the release of their 2016 new anthology, Political Punch, and the 16th anniversary, the Sweet 16, of Sundress's flagship journal, Stirring, which is dropping monthly still to this day and still showcasing some amazing writers every month. It is whew, I can't even begin to tell you what's going down at AWP this year. Oh, wait, I can tell you one more thing. The SAFTAcast will not be there. Well, let me rephrase that. We will be there, but we won't be. In other words, you may not hear my chainsaw voice floating through the aisles of AWP to the point where you say, wait a minute, I know that voice. Is that Scott C? No, it's not. I won't be there, but the SAFTAcast will be, kind of, sort of. For one, we'll be releasing a brand new episode the weekend of AWP, and it's going to be a very special one because our guest is one that we've long waited and many people have long wanted on this program, and it's an appropriate one since it will be our second birthday episode. Yes, we do one every year, and it's going to drop the first week of April. And also, see, we're going to be running a contest at AWP. So if you're in attendance, you can get a chance at some SAFTAcast and some Sundress merchandise. To get a grip on what we're going to be doing, pay attention to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more, as this week we intend to drop the announcement about it and all the details thereof. So keep a lock on us. We're going to be dropping some good stuff there for this contest. Speaking of dropping stuff, let's drop the interview right now. Well, first let me set it up for you. If you reach back into the annals of the SAFTAcast to episode 22A, you might recall that that was our first ever minisode, and on it we featured two awesome poets, Sarah Wynn and M. Mack. And at the time on the program, we said, hey, y'all gotta come back for full-length episodes. Well, the time has come, as Mack is with us today to talk about Theater of Parts and much, much more. We get into Star Trek a little bit, we get into talking about Neighbors, and Mack's amazing Etsy workshop, where there are many monsters that you can take home and make part of your life. You can check that out on the web by visiting etsy.com/shop/, and this is one word, What is Reality? I encourage you to check it out. They are some lovable monsters, and they are looking for good homes. We'll talk about that and more coming up, and just in case you're wondering here, indeed, Sarah Wynn will be joining us later this spring on the program for a full-length episode, but that is to come. Let us stay in the present tense, as I said, and get right into it with M. Mack right after our theme song.
Hello.
Mac, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Finally going on our promise of having you on for a full episode.
Yeah.
And what better time? I mean, things blowing up for you right now. But let us save that for later.
Okay.
I like to start off the show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. What was your favorite board game as a child?
Man. Clue?
Why Clue?
Oh, there's a follow-up burning question.
Oh.
I liked the characters.
What was interesting about them to you?
Well, I think I just meant like the fact that there were characters and a story to it, and that was the game. Yeah, I think just the fact that it had characters and a story. And then also I liked how color-coded everything was, you know, just to round out.
I mean, it's not like Chutes and Ladders where the narrative is Chutes and Ladders.
Right.
You went on a snake. Congratulations.
Although that is a good game.
Candyland was just, you know, welcome to diabetes.
Well, I do like all of the colors of Candyland. I think Candyland is very beautiful.
Were you much of a board game player as a kid?
Yeah.
Have you retained that into adulthood?
Yes and no. I get frustrated really easily when I'm learning them. So, I don't know. I don't often feel like learning them. If I can find like patient people who understand that the first time you play a game is going to be kind of frustrating, I think it could be good.
Are there any ones out now that you would recommend?
Well, I did play this game with my brother. It's a card-based game, Sentinels of the Universe. And that was a lot of fun. And it was also highly character and narrative driven.
Is that what appeals to you in just games in general, perhaps?
Maybe. I also like puzzles.
Puzzle games like Tetris?
No, puzzle games like... Well, I just played Undertale, the video game Undertale, and that, you know, the puzzles, I mean, people critique that game and say that the puzzles are not very good, but then that's part of the game, too. The characters who are giving you the puzzles make fun of the fact that the puzzles are not very challenging. But the puzzles are built into the narrative of the game, and that's part of what you have to beat. Or, like, I think Mario games often have puzzles in them.
When you were a kid, did that sense of narrative... Was that in a lot of the things that you enjoyed?
This is a good question, Scottsy. Probably. I mean, yeah, I guess so, because all of the things that I was doing by myself was making up stories. I had like 12 imaginary friends who I would, when I was a child, okay, you said when I was a kid, so I'm just going to go with this. I think there were 13 of them, actually. But I would act them out, and they each had like distinctive characteristics to how they would act. And so, yeah, I would, plan out these long scenes with the 13 characters and move about and act them out. Yeah, so now I've told you that.
Do I dare ask about some of the characters?
I don't remember all of them. Like, okay, so there was one whose name was Tanya, and I think her characteristic was that she was always chewing gum. So, I mean, they're not deep characters. One of the other characters was someone you might be familiar with, Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And also Robin. They were recurring characters. I can't remember any other names.
May not be deep for maybe like an MFA student, but to say a 7-year-old, chewing gum is a very deep character trait.
That's right.
That sense of narrative, do you find that that's still part of your life today? Is that like what maybe attracts you to a movie or something? It's like, well, how good's the story in this?
Well, yes. Right now... The easiest way that I can think of to answer it is to talk about Steven Universe.
Bring it.
Do you watch Steven Universe?
I have not yet, but I have been told I need to.
everyone should watch Steven Universe. So the thing that's exciting about Steven Universe is that of any, I would say of any show that's on now, but especially any cartoon show, it has the most sophisticated storytelling and the most consistent continuity, I think, of anything else. I feel like there's been a huge shift in television to, like, not having long story arcs, and to not really worrying about continuity from one season to a later season. Like, a good example of this would be the show Pretty Little Liars, where none of the plot holes ever get kind of dealt with, and I feel like the show is just always asking you to forget. I mean, I don't watch that anymore because of the transphobic villain that they released a while back. But anyway, but it's a good example because it's a mystery show and they're always putting out more clues, but they're not tying up old things. So Steven Universe is always picking back up on small details from previous episodes. And I think especially in a cartoon, it's unique to have continuity from one episode to the next, let alone across a season or across multiple seasons.
Yeah, I struggle to think. The only one that comes to my mind is the Venture Brothers, where they're they're in season six right now, and just this past week or so, they make a reference, and if you didn't watch season three like 8 years ago, get that in your mind, and suddenly the tumblers start clicking into place of what they've been setting you up for.
Yeah, I think that's really cool.
Do you specifically seek those out, the ones that can do that, or do you just happen by accident to find them?
I would say that I don't seek them out, but I continue to watch the ones that do it. So, like, I'm kind of a casual, I don't watch a lot of things as they're on, but I tend to, like, maybe on breaks from semester, catch up on things. If things start seeming like they're not keeping up with themselves, right? If the writing is just full of holes or whatever, then I'll just sort of let them go and I'll stop catching up. But I think if something is, and I know there's many ways for something to be well written, but I think it's respectful to a fan to acknowledge that they're going to remember things about the show. And I think too, there's a shift with shows that are being released all at once. They have a different kind of continuity than shows that think you're going to have a week between episodes, right? I feel like I've read things about television narratives changing with streaming because the experience of watching it is different because people are watching it all in a chunk instead of watching it episodically. And I tend to watch things all in a chunk, so holes and inconsistencies are more apparent. So I would say that for me, it's just kind of a test of if I'm going to keep on with something.
Yeah, they're trusting in you in those weekly ones to forget something from last week.
And I think that there's something, there can be cool things, right? Like I would say in poetry, that's something that I enjoy is if, like, I mean, I'm kind of a narrative poet, but I think that it's not very neat and there are holes and gaps and jumps. And I think that's fine. Like, but I think in order to do that, you kind of have to go back and pick up things like you were talking about with Venture Brothers. Like I think Star Trek does this where something that's really small in one episode will be returned to later and it will be a spinoff into, you know, a more developed storyline. I think that that kind of thing is really exciting.
But the occasional plot hole is okay. It's like acceptable casualty.
Right. It's like there's a threshold. Before you're just like, I can't hold all of these things in my brain anymore.
That's it. I give up. I that's it. I'm out. So aside from Steven Universe, what else are you right now digging on TV? Like, what are you mentioned fandom. Like, what are you a fan of right now? What's really like kicking in your mind? Like, oh my God, this is great.
The other thing that I'm watching is Star Trek Voyager for the first time. So
what are you thinking about it so far?
I like it. I like it a lot. I think it's also an interesting plot hole kind of show because you have to believe in the premise in order to like, or I don't know, sometimes you have to put aside the premise in order to like it, right? Because I like the character of Captain Janeway, and yet the whole show exists because of Janeway's morality and making a decision in the first episode to, you know, have them be lost. or how to have them continue to be lost. I don't know. I think there's an interesting tension, therefore, in Voyager of if you're sympathetic or not to the, well, to Janeway, and then also to the other characters.
I can see that. I mean, I'm gonna piss off a lot of Trekkers with this one. I tried to get into Voyager, but I couldn't get into it for the stupidest of all reasons. The ship looks like a shoe.
I think it looks like a what's the word? A sea creature, a squid.
Ooh. I had not thought
never,
of that.
I've never seen it looking like a shoe, but I will next time I watch. I will see.
It's like a slipper flying into space, and I just after that I was like, I can't take this seriously. I don't know why. I got nothing against it, Janeway. I got nothing against the characters. I do have issues with the Q episodes, but that's just me.
Yeah. But,
Are you a fan of the other Star Treks?
I'm kind of a newbie. One way that I say it is that I came from a Star Wars family, and I was really nervous the first time I came home and told my brothers that I wanted to start watching Star Trek, which sometimes gets a laugh, and sometimes people are like, what? So, actually, my brother, his wife is a Trekkie, and so he kind of went first. But my partner is really into Star Trek, and her favorite is Deep Space Nine. And I've seen some of that. Voyager is the first one that I've really, like,
I understand.
Tried to watch continuously. And I like it. And it's nice, too, like with anything like that, where there's a large universe and a lot of references. I guess I like complex narratives. but anyway, like the Q episodes, like, yeah, they're not maybe successful, but it's still a fun thing to try and do, where you tie together multiple versions of a thing.
I applaud the effort on them, but... You know, I kind of squirm when I'm watching it, going, yeah. But I understand. I understand. My partner got me into Star Trek many years ago. I was just like, you know what? This is going to sound stupid, but maybe you can relate. As a kid, I was on Star Wars because it's like, ooh, action, you know, unnecessary decapitations. And I'm watching Star Trek going, they're just talking. This is dull. Then I sat down and watched all of Next Gen during my PhD program, and I was like, okay, I'm in. I always find it interesting how we become fans of things.
Yeah.
So you mentioned siblings. How many siblings do you have?
I have two brothers.
Older, younger?
Older.
Dare I ask how old? Like, what the difference is, or just that doesn't
there's
matter?
There's 3.5 years between each of us.
Was it hard being the youngest in the family? Or was all the attention lavished on you?
I would say neither of those things. I don't know what their answer would be. I think about it in terms of influence, right? I think about things that I liked as a kid because my brothers liked them. A friend of mine in graduate school, we would talk about this with Transformers. He said that he was, well, we were the same age, and he said that he was generationally outside of Transformers. And I was like, but you have an older brother. Didn't your older brother like Transformers? And therefore, aren't you part of a generation that liked Transformers? Like, how come that didn't work the same way for you? So I think about it in that way. I don't know.
So where did you all grow up together?
We grew up in southern Indiana, the very southern tip on the Ohio River.
What was that like? Growing up in that part of the country.
What was it like? I don't know. I mean, it was kind of... There are a lot of factors. Like, well, I recently connected with another trans poet who grew up in the same town that I'm from. And that was an interesting phenomenon. And so then we talked about it. Like, what was it like to be in this... It's like kind of a small town, but it was also a suburb, and it wasn't until after I left that I realized that I lived outside of the third largest city in the state. So, like, kind of weird.
But it had a small town feel.
It had a small town feel. Everybody knew everything about everybody, and that was open and understood, right? If you ran into your neighbor, then you would immediately begin to discuss your other neighbors. Which is very different to where I live now, where you don't even really talk to your neighbors. Except there's been some kind of change in my neighborhood. And now when, like, we just got 3 feet of snow a few weeks ago and the whole neighborhood was out shoveling together. And I was like, I've never seen this happen before.
Crisis brings people together.
Well, I think, but there's been also like a lot of different people moving in, and I think they don't know, like they don't realize that the street previously had like a, hey, we're not friendly here kind of understanding. And so now like the people who moved in are nice, which is interesting. And they talk to one another. And then sometimes I'm like, should I talk to them? Should I continue as I have been? I don't know. It's a very strange thing, neighborhoods.
Do you prefer a neighborhood where people do talk to each other or where people are more isolationist?
Well, I'll tell you that I don't want to go back to a place where everybody knows everything about everybody and it's expected that you discuss it when you meet them on the street. I don't think that's my thing. But I like being friendly. I mean, I like helping people, right? So I like the community effort, snow shoveling, that kind of thing. There's one person that I see and I offer to help him with things sometimes. And, I think that's good, right? I think you should feel connected to the people that you're physically close to.
I wonder if it's just geography or is it also age that does that? Because I've talked to many people who say that, yeah, once you hit your mid-20s to 30s, you stop making friends. It becomes much more difficult.
Right.
Would you agree or disagree on that?
I think I would agree.
It's like the post-college years. You go out into the real world and you never talk to your neighbors in an apartment building.
I don't know if I believe in the real world, but but yeah, suddenly your friends are your coworkers and everybody that you're friends with has moved across different parts of the country, and then you realize you don't have any friends who live in the same town as you anymore, and then again your friends are your coworkers. I mean, yeah, I think that's a thing that happens in that time period for sure.
I'm just thankful for technology allowing me to keep up with the people,
right,
who have split apart.
And then I think too, like, my cousin went to college, and I don't think, well, I wonder about how the friend-making process is different. People talk about it in your 20s and 30s, but I think that the friend-making process for younger folks is different too, because if you do move somewhere else, you can keep in touch with your friends. I don't know. So I've heard people talking about it with college students. Like, are they going out and making friends, or are they keeping their existing friends?
It's like the point of the high school reunion is over and dead now. There's no point for it. Why do we need them anymore? I've been thinking about this because my 20th is coming up. And I'm like, why does it even exist anymore? Because we all have social media. We know where everybody is anyway.
I haven't thought of that.
I'm just going to send like a 3x5 card to everyone in my grade that just says, here's a little questionnaire. What do you do for a living? Are you married? Your spouse's occupation, if applicable. Do you have children? And are you dead?
Are That's these the things you want to know?
Yeah, once we get past that, there's nothing to talk about.
Huh.
Like, that's all I need to know.
That's it?
Yeah. That's all I need
to know. Not like, what have you done?
There were only a few people in high school I care about. I keep in touch with them. Everybody else is just kind of ancillary.
But the things you want to know is if they have a spouse and what their spouse does and if they have kids. You don't want to know, like, what they do and what they've been doing.
Yeah, well, their occupation might be on there as well. Fine. You know, just so you can gauge, am I better than you? That's all I want to know.
Oh, my. But that information you can get from Facebook.
Most of them, but some people are just, you know, like, I don't want to talk to you. Well, that's fine, but you're going to see me at the reunion and act like I'm your oldest friend.
I've not gone to a reunion. I have avoided them thus far.
I went to my 10, and I lied my ass off everywhere.
So then your 3x5 card needs to be bigger to allow for folks to embellish.
True. Well, I told a different story to every single person of what I was doing.
Did you invent post-it notes?
No, but I did tell somebody that I worked in Albanian pornography. And another one was that I trafficked zoo animals. So, and no one knew what to believe. I was okay with this. It's about the narrative again. How do you lie good?
Or many and contradictory.
Back to the whole thing of puzzles. Are you more into visual puzzles, word puzzles?
This is going to be kind of interesting. And I like tactile puzzles. Like, you have four pieces of wood and you can fit them together into a shape if you put them all in the exact right order and the exact right orientation. Like, kind of thing, or like the pieces of metal and you have to figure out how to get them apart. But I hate kind of spatial logic puzzles. And the reason I say this is that in video games, I kind of like spatial logic puzzles. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I think word puzzles, I think in video games, often they're logic based, like word logic based.
I could never do puzzles. So I envy those who can. I suck at it. It's like I look at a Scrabble board and my vocabulary becomes that of a 5-year-old. Ooh, dog!
I really like Scrabble. I think it's because it has so many things you have to pay attention to at the same time. Because it's words, but it's also space. You have to, you know the number of spaces that you want and where they're going to be. And also maybe you're thinking about points of the spaces. And it's just kind of...
I understand. You know, so many of my friends who are writers or teachers, they love it. And I'm like, I just suck at it.
I like to play with it. You know what I really like for like writing games is Boggle. And in Boggle, the spatial part is already done for you. And that's confined. Like that's defined. And then you are just looking, like working within it. So I would use that. Actually, I've used that a lot to like make word groups for poems.
Never thought of that as a writing technique, as to kind of get the brain going.
Well, on Boggle, if you're going to use it for writing games, just don't get the like new electronic one that makes a lot of buzzing sounds and stuff.
You want the classic.
The classic. You know. I think I have a Boggle twist or something. But yeah, it still has pieces that you shake and then you kind of lock them in. And it has a timer built in, but I don't use the timer because that would be annoying.
If you're in a competitive game, yes. But if you're doing it for writing, nah.
Yeah.
Let your mind wander then as you look over the letters.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you really are fond of tactile puzzles and such. Are you a tactile person in general?
I think yes. Lately, I've been trying to figure out how that plays out. Like, I never considered it to be like my learning style, you know, like in school when you were trying to figure out what your learning style was. But I have been reading about it and I've been trying to figure out ways to like incorporate kinesthetic things into college classrooms. But like I have a bunch of stress toys of various types that I'm always giving to people in meetings and offering to students. But then also like I make things. So materials matter a lot to me. So like I sew things and I'm often constructing things out of pieces of felt or other materials. And so,
yeah, I wanted to ask about that. How did you get started? Cause I know you make little monsters and such. And so I want to ask, where did that come from? When did this all start?
This is a great question. I don't know. Well, I've always made things. Like, my mom always made things. I always made things when I was a kid. And I do remember when I was a kid wanting to make stuffed animals. And I do remember at one point, like, drawing a stuffed animal on construction paper, like two pieces of construction paper, and then stapling it together and stuffing it with something. So I remember that as a kind of stuffed animal making route. But it started, I was in school, and I was doing a project that I was finding really, really difficult. I just couldn't stop thinking about sewing monsters out of felt. And so one night I wrote to my professor and I was like, look, I'm having a terrible time with this project. I'm going to take a night off and I'll tell you tomorrow what I'm going to do. And she was like, okay. And I went through all my craft supplies and found some, like, I don't know, some denim and some buttons and things that I'd saved from other projects, and just made a couple of monsters out of what I had lying around. And I was like, oh, this is good. And then it just kind of went from there into putting more intention into what I was making them out of. But yeah, it's been like 5 years now, I think. And it's important. It's important to how I think about things. I've been busy lately, but it's nice to have a project going that you can pick up and work on with your hands. I think it helps to think through other things.
Is it like a form of meditation almost?
I think so. Especially, I find, especially if I'm making something for someone, that it's a very intentional practice, and it's very thinking about the person and what they would like, and thinking about them while you're working on it. I find that really nice. But it can also be not necessarily a person, but a purpose. So, like, I always wanted to make the rest of the characters, but so far I've only made the one character from my first book of poetry, and I've sewn this one character several times, and putting the stuffed version of him into real life situations has led to a lot of poems about that character being in that situation. That's kind of cool, because that's a direct tie between the two. But even if it's not direct like that, I think if you're feeling stuck in your writing or in something that you're doing, and you go and do another kind of thing with your body, I think it really can help with that kind of back channel processing.
Allows you to perhaps see a problem or a dilemma in a new light.
Well, there's this thing, like the best thing about crafts or art or anything is when you're doing it and you're completely doing it and you're not thinking about how much time has passed and you're not thinking about anything else. And that's called a flow activity. And they're supposed to be really good for your brain, because if you're only thinking about the thing that you're doing, then all of the things that you're worried about or working on have time to kind of develop while you're completely distracted in your flow activity, right? So it's like, a lovely thing.
It's kind of like clearing the mind in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I got a lot of junk from the day and everything, like the concept of mindfulness in a way of just, you are in the moment, you are in there. I keep being told that I should get into arts and crafts, but as a child, I sucked at it, and I've just never been able to get over that in my head.
Well, you have to decide if you sucked at it because you hated it, or if you hated it because you sucked at it.
Definitely the latter.
Okay, well then you should try, and you should not show anyone what you're working on, and you should try a lot of different types of things. You can also jump on the adult coloring book bandwagon. I must admit that I'm sitting next to a book called The Mindfulness Coloring Book, Anti-Stress Art Therapy for Busy People, and my confession is that I have not opened it since I bought it.
But it's there for when you do need it.
Well, you would think. I think I'm just carrying it around and I'm not... I don't know. I don't know if this was successful.
It might be that just the act of carrying it, therefore, that might be. When it comes to arts and crafts, is it just the monster making that you do, or are there other ones that you also work on?
There's a lot of things that I like to do. Now, primarily, it's fiber arts, different kinds of embroidery, which kind of goes along with the monsters because I use that stuff in their features. I do needle felting, I crochet, I sew by machine some things, but I'm not very good at like garment construction. I've also not had a lot of practice, so I don't know. I mean, like, it's one of those things where I want to do more of it and get good at it. My mom sewed her whole life and she's incredible, and I'm like jealous and I want to like try and catch up, but I don't know if that's really realistic.
Did your mother teach you to sew, or was it self-taught?
She taught me. I mean, I grew up around sewing. And so when I started sewing the monsters, it was pretty much, I figured it out as I went, just kind of applying things I'd learned in other crafts. She taught me a few embroidery stitches in the beginning, and then I just started from there, kind of going out and finding tutorials and books of different stitches and things like that.
As time went on, you developed your own set of skills with it.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta say, I dig them, to be honest.
And thank you.
I hope you know, this is my encouragement to our listeners. Go check them out. They are totally awesome.
Thank you very much. I dig them too.
It ties right back to your childhood. You're coming up with the stories for each one of them, and they're
exactly. I was just thinking that. Right, because they each have a name, and they each have kind of a storyline and things they like to do, because they develop personality as you put different colors and patterns and facial expressions. They have very expressive faces. Positioning a mouth onto a creature, you know, there's a lot of differences possible just by how you do that.
When you go to create one of them, do you have an idea in your head of what you're going to do, like a sketch, or, you know, either physical or mental, or is it just let's just start and see where it goes.
Sometimes either way. Sometimes I have just like some colors in mind that I'd like to work with together, and I just start kind of making shapes. But usually usually there's got to be some kind of impetus for starting, right? So sometimes I'll just be going around, like I have on my attendance sheets in class, I'll have a monster sketched, and then I'll go and try and make something out of it. So usually I make a very rough sketch of like a body shape or a face, and then try and figure out the scale of how big it will be. I kind of consider it, I have this one pair of scissors that I don't know what it is about this set of scissors, but they like fit my hand really well, and they're sharp enough to cut the felt, but they're not so sharp that I'm terrified of cutting myself. And I just kind of cut with that pair of scissors. And I think of it kind of like sketching. I just sort of keep cutting the shapes until they seem right. and that they're sized appropriate to the other shapes that I've already done. And then they just kind of come together like that. And I just keep kind of building. And the thing about the monsters is, and this is true of when I learned to draw in college. Like, I had taken drawing lessons when I was a kid, but I never was very good at it. And in college, I was a photography minor. And one of the required classes was a drawing class. And it was like the hardest class I took in college. It was like 8 hours a week sitting in a chair drawing. And I didn't know that I didn't think that I could draw. My professor didn't think that I could draw. At one point, I had to draw a life-size self-portrait of myself. Anyway, but what I learned is that a lot of art is just in the detail. So if you don't think you can draw, but you keep adding detail to your drawing and you keep, you know, applying shading or applying lines or, you know, it's very additive. Suddenly your terrible drawing looks kind of like you after all. And the same is with the monsters, you know, an outline of a body shape doesn't look like too much. You put a couple of eyes on there, okay. You put a little bit of detail in the eye, and then you put some eyelashes, and then it has dimples on its face. And just like the more detail that you add, it becomes more lively. And so I think, I don't know, I think often back to my drawing class when that's happening, that it's just so additive. And when you put these things together, then it looks like something, whereas you didn't think it really looked like anything when you started.
I'm not going to ask how you did in the drawing class.
It was hard, and a lot of crying, and a lot of my professor telling me, this is terrible. Don't you understand this is terrible? And me being like, yes. Yes, I do.
Believe me, I can relate to that.
I think I got a B+, and I was so proud of that B+. Gosh, and I was terrified for like, I don't remember putting it off because I think that I knew that the whole minor depended on me taking this class. But you had to take the studio art classes first, the kind of studio foundations. Then you took the art class. I mean, the drawing class. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I can totally relate. Bad experiences when I went for my bachelor's in film. And yeah, I will only tell this anecdote. I ended off one of my 16mm films with the statement of, I am a terrible filmmaker. And the professor looked over at me and went, yes, you are.
Oh, no.
I am not ashamed, though, of it.
Well, that's good.
I realized that the filmmaker they wanted me to be was not the storyteller that I am. So anyway, though, I'm always fascinated with people who can do things with their hands, because I grew up in a family where, you know, my father could use his hands to build things. Mm-hmm. You know, I never developed that skill because I resisted. It wasn't me, and I kind of regret it now when I'm like trying home repair.
Oh gosh, home repair is a whole another ball game. Except the only thing that I would say is similar about home repair and crafts and art is that it involves a lot of like critical thinking and analysis skills. And then, like, going out and learning how to do something rather quickly. And then coming back and applying what you think you've learned. All in a very short period of time.
And it's like, if your pipe bursts, you got to know how to figure this one out really quickly.
Yeah, like, really fast. You got to figure out what to do really fast. Yeah, I've been helping my mom renovate her house for the past year or so. And I've learned to do a lot of things that I never thought that I would learn to do. And a lot of it is just patience and like being okay with messing things up over and over and over again. Also, being comfortable, this is something that I'm not comfortable with, is doing the same thing twice. Like, I want to do something once and not have to do that again. And in home renovation, I'm learning that you often have to redo work that you've already done, which is very frustrating.
Everything works on the directions. In a perfect world, this thing fits together properly.
Well, but then that's a whole another set of skill, too, is learning to read the directions for whatever thing, because they always leave out a step or put the drawing backwards or, you know, I think reading instructions is like a set of critical thinking and analysis skills all on its own.
Yeah, I use
filling in gaps.
Actually, use IKEA directions as a way to talk about analysis.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a really good idea.
Because analysis is simply taking a thing, breaking
what
it.
What is said and what is unsaid. A lot.
Exactly.
A lot is unsaid.
I hadn't thought of it that way. I just use it as like, here's an object. Blow it apart into its constituent parts, look at each part individually, and shove it back together, and what do you got?
That's brilliant. Last time I was on the show, Sarah Ann Wynn and I were talking about our Monster Works revision workshop that we did at SAFTA.
Yes.
And we had brought a lot of different kinds of texts that were in specific genres, and we used those in a bunch of revision prompts, and we brought an IKEA instruction manual from my house project as one of our very genre-specific texts for people to work within.
I could see that totally. I'm surprised there aren't more pieces of poetry about instruction manuals out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there is that. I think it's like a freshman composition prompt that you have to teach an alien how to make a peanut butter sandwich, and the alien doesn't know what a sandwich or peanut butter is, so your instructions have to like include all of the steps.
Ah, yes. When you get down to it, the most basic thing is so complicated.
Right.
Let's talk for a moment here, because we, you know, you mentioned earlier things are busy right now, and one of the reasons I know that things are busy right now is Theater of Parts is coming out, like, very soon.
Very soon. I dreamed about it last night.
What was the dream, dare I ask?
I dreamed. It's not that exciting. I often also do my to-do list in my sleep. So I dreamed that the proof arrived, and I just kind of sat and spent some time with it. Not reading it, just, like, spending time with it, you know, as a tactile object. Yeah, that was my dream. Not very exciting.
But
it's very exciting.
Still, you probably woke up with a smile on your face
I sure did.
I gotta say, the cover, which is, like, mind-blowing to look at.
Like, mind-blowingly good? Yeah.
Like, it just, you see it, and anyone who knows what it is referring to, reference visually, goes, mm-hmm. Oh my god, that's brilliant.
Thank you to T.A. Noonan for the brilliance.
I got to see the stages of it, and I'm like, holy, this is beautiful. But I haven't seen the book yet. I'm not privy to that information yet. So being that it's about to drop or may have just dropped, when does it officially drop?
We're thinking March 15th.
Okay, so we're right, in a couple weeks after this podcast airs, mm-hmm. goes live. For those who are not aware of it, like myself, help us a little bit understand it. What is Theater of Parts?
Well,
can it be described? Or is it something you experience?
It can be described. It also can be experienced. Theater of Parts is a work of impossible theater exploring the impossible body. And I think the best way to explain it is to describe the characters. So the main character, or the first character that appears, is Milk with Toast. Milk with Toast is a complicated character. He is the purple cross-dressing cockroach from Berkeley Breathe's Bloom County and Outland. He is also Casper Milk Toast, who was the first. This is where the word milk toast in the English language comes from. In the 1920s, H.T. Webster had a comic strip called The Timid Soul. And the main character was a pushover, a man who is easily dominated. These are the words that are in the definition of the English word milquetoast now. And his name was an intentional misspelling of the food, milquetoast, which is literally toast floating in a bowl of milk. So very bland, very non-specific.
Just as a side note, was that ever really a thing?
Was whatever thing? Oh, I think
actual
it was
actual milquetoast.
I think so.
Because I never thought about that. I'd never thought about doing that in my life. I'm just here. I'm going to stick a piece of bread in a bowl of milk.
I mean, you still see pictures of it on the internet for snowstorms, right? When people go and buy their bread and milk.
That's a very good point, yeah.
Make milk toast. Oh, evidently you can add other ingredients like cocoa, raisins, paprika. Now I'm seeing on Wikipedia, I'm seeing milk toast in Asia, milk toast in Serbia, milk toast in Norway and Sweden. I don't know.
Just never thought of that as food.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to do some research on this now.
Well, that's what happened, right? So that's what happened. My friend and I were watching Buster Keaton films, and in the Netflix description for the movie Go West, it said, a young milquetoast and his beloved cow, Brown Eyes. And it was like, what? What is this word? And then we looked it up, and we thought for sure it would be pronounced milquetoast. And the online dictionaries were just saying milquetoast, milquetoast, milquetoast. And we were like, what? And then we found the comic strip and then milquetoast from Berkeley Breathed. And within a couple of days, I had written this kind of, what's the word? Origin story for this character that was once a man and became a cockroach and chose to begin. Well, I question the idea of cross-dressing because it implies the gender, you know, it's tied to the gender binary, but this character understands it as cross-dressing and applying gendered items onto their body. And I don't know. And then I just have spent several years with this character who's very important to me, who is a lot of different things at once.
Much
and like, has a kind of rich, varied history.
Much like milquetoast in Outland and Bloom County, he's a very complicated character at times.
Yeah.
So, impossible drama for impossible bodies. It sounds so alluring.
Yeah, so I only got as far as milquetoast. But yeah, so there's milquetoast, and then there's a poet, and there's the actor. So there's the poet and the actor. And basically anything can happen. One way that I like to say it is the poet whose body is ether. Sorry, I messed it up. The actor whose body is ether and the poet whose body is. So often what's being enacted is that the actor's body can do anything and the poet's body can't. And well, there's also a pair of tits. Well, can we say that on the show?
Oh, yeah.
So the actor removes the actor's breasts and they become characters throughout the book.
Sentient or?
Oh yeah.
Oh okay. I mean it just sounds so amazing in so many different directions in so many ways, and I'll be honest, I've read your previous chapbook and I was like, holy, oh my god, this is brilliant.
Well, Traveling is in Theater of Parts. So Traveling is the chapbook from Hyacinth Girl Press that came out last summer. And what I had done was, throughout Theater of Parts, there's kind of an alternating between the primary dramatic story, which is the play that has the poet, the actor, milquetoast, and various others, the tits, and then these more personal narrative-seeming pieces, dense prose, still in somewhat in dramatic forms, but different from the primary play of the book. And so in the book, they're spaced throughout. And so what I did for the chapbook was I pulled some of them. I think it's a very different reading experience because in the book, none of the sequences appear together. The pieces of them, they're often, I think, four pieces long. And they're, you never go from scene one to scene two. You always have something in between. And in the chapbook, the ones that I put together, you read from one to the other all the way through. And I think it's very different. And so one of the things that in Theater of Parts, and I kind of talked about this earlier with TV, is that it is narrative, but it asks you to take on a lot of pieces and to hold them all up as you move forward. And particularly with the actor's body, right? Anything can happen to the actor's body, and it's not permanent. So something can happen and then unhappen, and you're reading a lot of different types of texts moving through, but my hope is that they all add up to something by the end.
The parts become a whole.
Yeah. Well, they also resist a whole. So I think it's an interesting question. But yeah, so it's all about, really, it's all about how a physical body is gendered. And how much of that is controllable and how much of it is not. And I liked Susan Tichy wrote an incredible blurb for the book. And she said that these are stories that cannot be performed, cannot be staged, but must be lived. And I thought that was amazing.
Touched on some very deep questions there. Ones that I don't know if the answers are, well, they're obviously not easy answers to find. A lot of soul searching involved. So deep book, but I will tell you, I for one am looking forward to reading and checking this out when it drops. I can't believe the hour has gone by like it has.
Yes.
It's speeded along. But before we let you go, Mac, where can the folks find you online? Want to check out
where
your stuff?
Folks find me online. Well, I am at mixmac.com, which is mxmac.com. I'm on Twitter at mixmacpoet. The plushies are on Facebook as What Is Reality Plushies. We're on Etsy as well. And also Instagram. I have kind of poetry and plushy things happening.
Well, we will throw the link up there so people can see the plushies and the monsters that we have been talking about.
Oh, and also, while we're talking about plushies and Theater of Parts... I am raffling off some of the Milquetoast plushies with pre-orders for the book. So I have sewn Milquetoast the Cockroach from Theater of Parts, and so currently we're taking pre-orders for Theater of Parts at Sundress, and I'm going to raffle off a couple of the Milquetoast plushies.
Kick ass. Well, we will throw the link up there definitely on this episode so folks can check that out and get their chance at not only getting a copy of Theater of Parts, but also a chance to have their very own version of one of the primary characters here. That should be totally awesome. SAFTCast hosts are not eligible. There we go. Mac, it is awesome to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on today and being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk with you. Glad we could talk about narrative.
Well, I'm sure we could talk about narrative for a long time.
Yes.
It dominates every way I think about the world. So, but maybe for another day, we can save that for a conversation. Please feel free to come back whenever. We love you.
Yeah.
It is awesome to talk with you. Take care. We will talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
The SAFTCast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTCast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.